Hello and welcome to the Night's Rewatch, covering the final season of Game of Thrones for rewatchers with a companion podcast for every episode, brought to you by Bolin Media, hosted by myself, Ross Bolin, and my dear friend Mr. Barrett Dudley. This final season of the Night's Rewatch was originally recorded in the summer of 2020 when things were chaotic professionally for Barrett and I, and as such, we were forced to put it behind our paywall on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. But in celebration of the first Game of Thrones spinoff, House of the Dragon, premiering August 21st on HBO, we are waking the dragon and releasing it for all to consume. Please note, as this episode was recorded in 2020, it may contain dated references and jokes. We are now on TikTok at Oysters, Clams, and Cockles. Also follow us on Instagram at Oysters, Clams, Cockles, and on Twitter at Clams and Cockles for House of the Dragon updates and content. Finally, if you enjoy OCC, please take a moment to rate and review our show on your preferred platform. Now, enjoy this episode of The Night's Rewatch.
Night gathers. And now my rewatch begins.
Welcome back to Oysters, Clams, and Cockles, still and always, Barrett, the number one Game of Thrones podcast in the realm. I'm your host, Ross Bolin, here with my dude, Barrett Dudley, to finally reunite all members, old and new, of the Night's Rewatch 2, after a full year, dive back into the final season of the arguably greatest television spectacle we'll ever see, Season 8 of Game of Thrones, episode by episode, ad-free, right here on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. Barrett, how are you today, sir?
Ross, there's really only one thing that I can say to you at this moment.
What's that?
But both me brothers were soldiers.
Wow, we needed it. Oh my God, I've waited so long, man. Dude, did you see that one of our interns made us a Both Me Brothers Were Soldiers meme weeks in advance to this, out of excitement?
I did not. Have we posted it?
I think we did. If we haven't, I definitely need to. I'll send it to you. It's phenomenal. It says something along the lines of, like, all members of the Night's Rewatch when Barrett and Ross announced that they're going back in or something, and it's the clip of the little girl. And she's the best. And that's really the only reason we're doing this, truth be told.
Yeah.
We're just trying to get back to that one scene.
We're trying to get back to that. I mean, that one scene really just like that regardless of how you did feel or how you feel now about the season, it gave us that scene and the greatest Game of Thrones line of all time. So really, it's like, how bad can it be?
I completely agree. Huge thanks to all of you here supporting, all the members of the Crustacean Nation and Mollusk Militia for riding with us back into Season 8 after a full year. I can't believe it's only been a full year, first off. Feels a lot longer than that to me.
Yes, it does. It does feel longer than a year. Had the last 6 weeks gone by in a more traditional manner, I don't know if it would feel like we were, you know, back to the beginning here.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. It's weird. And I think that probably is because, I don't know, because it kind of fizzled at the end a little bit.
Right.
I think it's just really, just kind of like lost to the winds in a bit.
The season landed in a strange place for people, right?
Yeah.
Where it was like, it was this weird finish. And we'll kind of get into that because honestly, fuck it, let's just start discussing the episode. They really, from the get-go, stumbled out of the gate here in Season 8 because, like, okay, during the previously on Game of Thrones or whatever, obviously it doesn't say that anymore, but the reminder sequence, it was, like, semi-comical. Them running through the Season 7 stuff you needed to know, getting into this first episode with a year of breathing room, laughing in my head about, like, what I was about to watch unfold, because they set it up like there's all these setups from Season 7 that they present you with, and it's comical because Barrett, so very many of those incredible 7-season-long setups amount to what your word fizzle, I don't even believe, does it justice. In some cases, they just flat out ignored or forgot about some of the things they set up. In some cases, like with the Night King, obviously we'll get into, the setup led to one of the strangest deliveries of all time. It's just like this, it just reminded me, these dudes, the final season for them was about the spectacle. It was the period in cultural history and sort of solidifying their place in it, executing the big moments they'd come up with or that they'd been told about by George R. R. Martin, and then completely failing to connect the dots. It feels like, in hindsight, that they were more focused on like the documentaries, the marketing. Like these two dudes, Benioff and Weiss, the showrunners, they signed up to make the greatest TV show ever made based on the greatest books ever that weren't totally written. They did not sign up to write the end of the greatest books ever, not totally written themselves, and then make the TV show too. So it just reminded me, like I was thinking about this last night too, as I began my rewatch, the fat man is to blame, folks. Never forget that. George R. R. Martin is the one who left us hanging in the wind. And it's crazy to me that he really, GRRM, he really let Benioff and Weiss serve as like scapegoats. This dude never stepped out of the shadows to be like, hey, everybody, it's not all on them. Remember, there's a situation here that involves me too. No, to my knowledge, that never happened. Like, he just let these dudes take the fall.
Yeah, I had very similar thoughts last night. And one of the notes that I have here is as I was watching this first episode, and I didn't know how I was going to feel watching back. I think overall, I expected to kind of be in this more positive mind frame. And like, now I know what happens. I know kind of what to expect from the season. Like, let's run it all back. And I had this feeling that I was going to enjoy the whole thing more on this go round. Now I'm not so sure after having rewatched this episode last night.
But why is
because,
that?
Because it didn't, it actually, I think it hit worse than it did the first time for me. Because at least the first time, you know, you are amped, you are jazzed to get this thing going, right?
Sure, like, sure.
I got 6 episodes left. We're closing this thing out. Like, how excited am I? I've never seen this before. Like, it's almost like, especially for that first episode, you could have thrown anything up there, and you would have been just pumped to have Game of Thrones back. But I'm watching, and I was thinking about the writing. I was thinking about some of the lines. I was thinking about the story and the plot points. I was thinking about, like you said, about how they went into this season with like a big board, you know, of the things that they needed to hit and wrap up on and touch on. And then it's like, because the feeling that I got while watching this episode is almost like they're playing bingo, right? They're just like checking off boxes.
Yes.
Of stuff that they needed to do instead of... And I mean,
instead of telling a story,
and I understand where that pressure came from, right? Like this, you're suddenly, you've been gone for 18 months. You look around at the cottage industry that you've created. You have the biggest television show of all time, certainly of the modern era. You know, like and kind of pushing past stuff like MASH or whatever. I mean, this is the biggest thing of the century. At the very least.
Entertainment-wise, I still don't think that can be argued.
Yes. You just get all tied up thinking about all these things that you feel like you're required to do to try to make as many people as possible happy. Because at this point, these guys probably didn't even feel ownership of this story anymore because of the crazed fandom out there, right? So it's just set up for failure, really, because this was going to be so hard to execute. And then you add to that the fact that they didn't have material to go off of. And I'm watching this, what I started thinking about is like, okay, is there any fantasy stuff out there that was ever as good as seasons 1 through 6 of Game of Thrones?
On television?
No, movies, anything.
People are going to argue stuff like Lord of the Rings, Star
right?
Wars, but that's the only things that ever reached the level like this.
Well, but I mean specifically, I don't even mean space or sci-fi. I mean fantasy. I mean that this sword and shield genre, the Lord of the Rings films are the only other thing that I think quality-wise even comes close to seasons 1 through 6 of Game of Thrones.
I completely agree.
And when you think about this genre, what you typically get is like mediocre schlock with some cool swords and shields and dragons and like maybe a good thread or yarn in there or
Barrett,
two.
Barrett, to your point,
but this genre typically does not yield groundbreaking, incredible story.
Remember how many people, through the course of seasons 1 through 6 in particular, were so hesitant to watch Game of Thrones because it was fantasy. Oh, it looks nerdy. Oh, the dragons and the warlocks and shit. Ah, nerds.
Yes.
And it was like,
yes.
That. You know why that existed? Because nobody had ever succeeded in this realm before like this. Look at The Witcher, dude, as an example of like,
great, yes,
taking a shot at the same type of genre. Can you hold them up next to each other? Abso-fucking-lutely not. That would be insane.
Yeah, and I mean, you just go back to any of the movies, like any of the stuff about like the Knights of the Round Table or what's Arnold? Is that Arthur? any of the Arthur stuff?
Arnold, King Arnold.
Like any of the times that they tried it, there was that weird Christian Bale and Matthew McConaughey movie where they're riding dragons around. There's so many examples of movies and television that does sword and shield stuff that attempts this genre. That it's just really kind of rote, and it's not necessarily that it's bad. It's just not like high-end quality prestige stuff. And so I'm watching this episode, and that's the feeling that I'm getting, Ross. I'm getting the, like, removed from George's works. This is just really like run-of-the-mill fantasy.
Yeah, and I think what made Game of Thrones so different from all the run-of-the-mill fantasy was the level of intelligence with which the show was written, the dialogue, the complexity of the characters. And that's what we lost when it, to your point, became about the big bullet points and just trying to rap, dude. Look, in my opinion, they got here and it was like season 8 was like the celebration for them, mm-hmm. right? This is essentially them throwing like the worst party of all time in the cold, in the middle of the night, to celebrate one of the greatest accomplishments in the history of arguably like human history to do this story and it, on the scale that they did. I'm going to start like, so first of all, let me say, I'm with you that when I started watching this episode, I was waiting to see how I was going to feel. Now, I wasn't disappointed so much. It wasn't that I wasn't going to enjoy it or enjoy it even less than the first go through or something, but I did find myself very quickly recognizing, okay, we're going to be doing a lot of ripping. We're going to be making a lot of jokes about the silliness and some of the missteps here. This is going to be a lot of fun to discuss some of the things that went awry.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and just to have new perspective on it as well.
And try to give them more credit where it's due as well.
This is even what this amounts to is really like a postmortem of sorts, you know, where this is going back and it's kind of removing the emotion from it. It's removing that like the knee jerk reaction of like, oh, I'm pissed. Oh, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And kind of analyzing why these mistakes were made. And if it was even possible to avoid them, like, I start thinking about, well, what was one of the big things that we really like talked about last year? As far as what they should have done. And we talked about how maybe Benioff and Weiss should have passed it off to a guy like the Cogman, somebody that was still a little bit more invested in the story. And even if they had done that, like maybe some of these pieces would have been drawn together a little bit better. But I still think that at the end of the day, what they really needed was 2 more full seasons. They needed 20 more episodes. And if they weren't going to get that because of the actors wanting to leave, because the contract's expiring, because like just like because of all these various like, you know, bumps in the road that they weren't going to be able to overcome, if it boiled down to you got one more season and we're not even doing 10 episodes, I don't know if anybody could have like landed this plane properly.
And I think in fairness, Barrett, it's a combination of all these different things, right? That's a big part of it, man. I genuinely believe that these guys were up against it. Like I said, they didn't sign up to write the ending. They didn't realize they were going to have to do this. Yeah. Things went the way they did, and they found themselves holding the most popular story ever that's not the Bible and having to literally write the ending. And they fucking failed. And it is what it is. Let's start diving into some of the pieces that made me go, Harry Strickland. He's introduced, and you're like, it's an example of, like, you can tell George R. R. Martin was like, and there's going to be a guy, Harry Strickland, head of the Golden Company. He's a character. And that was like one of the notes they wrote on their napkin. And then when they were getting to the season, they were like, well, okay, we already cast Harry. He has zero importance. None of his existence ends up mattering at all. In fact, the setup for the scene where he eventually is outside the gates, like ready to do battle, and then all of his men die in like 20 seconds.
Yeah.
Just makes it even funnier that we're introduced to him in a way in this first episode, like he's going to be important. And it's like, we were laughing about this dude so much during season 8, even like during the original watch. In the rewatch, Harry Strickland is even more absurd of a character.
Yeah. Yeah. He is a total,
just out of nowhere.
He's a total nothing burger, man. Like this. I guess you needed a representative of the Golden Company.
But just gets wiped out in 20 seconds. This is an example of like, yeah, what?
This does seem like something that, like, if it was going to be so inessential, why even introduce this character? Like, we know the Golden Company's there. We know that we know that they're hanging out with the Iron Fleet. Like, we don't, I don't know. I'm not sure if this formal introduction to Harry Strickland really mattered. And let me do you one better. It's especially bad because on rewatch, Cersei's incessant hand-wringing over the elephants,
dude,
is so bad.
It's literally the okay, so I noticed it as like, it's almost as if they were
I really wanted those elephants.
They're writing excuses into the episodes. Like, the excuses start to pile up in episode 1. They're inserting dialogue to write off reasons for things not existing.
The elephants just stuck out to me as like, as something.
It's still hilarious, yes.
As something pretty funny.
And oh my God. The first time Euron pops on screen in this episode, it might have been the most giddy I got throughout the rewatch of season 8, episode 1, because he's not quite Lin-Manuel Miranda or whatever in his Dark Materials.
I love that you can't say the last name Miranda.
Miranda.
How is Miranda becoming Miranda for you?
No disrespect to Lin. But it's not quite that bad. But if you consider the scope of introducing a character on the level of Euron 7 seasons into the most popular show ever made, it is one of the great missteps in television history. This Jack Sparrow motherfucker that we made fun of for so many hours, his presence in this season is an utter and total abortion.
So, speaking, just doing this autopsy, right? Kind of referencing back to what we were talking about the length, about the amount of time that they had.
Yes.
You know, you start, another thing that you start to wonder about is, okay, well, if you tell them after 2 seasons, after 3 seasons, even, like, basically you get to the Red Wedding and then you tell them, here's how much time you have to finish this out now. You wonder if they kind of like pull back on some stuff that some of the weaker stuff from seasons 4, 5, 6, 7, like the Sand Snakes, like Dorne in general, like Euron Greyjoy, like if you could have just put, because they're trying to do the books justice, right? And they're trying to include as much as they possibly can from them to get all of this awesome world building, you know, brought in. But if you know from the outset, if you know much earlier in time, that you have this, that you don't have a huge, huge, huge runway, then you might be able to like pull some of that up, that kind of that extracurricular stuff that doesn't matter as much, pull some of that out and start kind of inserting some of the more essential stuff, and then get to a better place by the time that that your last season rolls around.
How dare you disrespect the water gardens in Dorne?
I mean, who doesn't love a water garden?
My walks through the water gardens in Dorne are the only thing keeping me sane during this COVID shit, Barrett. Yeah. How dare you? I'll give you another example of a scene where I was like, well, I'll bet they wish they had this one back. The idiotic crossbow setup between Bronn and Qyburn to make us think he's going to assassinate Jaime and Tyrion.
Yeah.
And then and him being like, this fucking family. And it's like, it has good lines in it. Like that little scene, you're like, okay, all right, this is wild. Bronn, man, what's he going to do? Hey, Barrett, do you remember how this plays out?
I do. Well, no, actually, I don't really. I remember.
Oh, because it doesn't really play out.
I remember Bronn being in a room with Tyrion and Jaime later and pointing a crossbow at them and then saying something that just kind of, you know, wipes the whole thing away.
Yeah, he basically shows up and he's like, I might do it. And they're like, oh, no, Bronn, no. And he's like, all right, I won't. But A, I want y'all to know this was annoying for me and also I'm rich now. That's it. That's the story of Bronn, by the way. Great character.
This is a scene in particular that didn't, I think this is one that bothered me less. But just pushing aside what happens, what becomes of the storyline, this didn't bother me as much.
No, it was a good scene. I'm telling you.
I mean, you want Bronn back in the picture somehow, and I think that
they forced him in there, man.
Look, man, there's really, to really like run through the plot pieces of it, there's no way that Cersei understands how loyal or unloyal Bronn is to these guys. What she would know of him is that he is a guy that is willing to murder for money. Like that's what he started as. That's what he was. Like she wasn't privy to those scenes with Bronn and Tyrion down in the dungeons when Tyrion's locked up, right?
That's a fair point.
Like so it's not totally out of the realm of possibility and, you know, common sense that she'd be like, this dude's still here. He's still hanging out in King's Landing. He didn't go run off with Tyrion and Jaime. And I know he loves money and hasn't actually gotten what he wants yet.
And I refuse to be in the same scenes as him.
Yeah. And so, what's a better option for her, right?
No, like, I think the play makes sense. It was laughable to us because as viewers, we're like, there is a 0.0% chance that Bronn takes out either of these guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I'll say this as a positive. Seeing Bronn come on screen and then later towards the end of the episode, the Hound, even though I will say the Hound's dialogue in this one was not houndy. They missed repeatedly trying to force it. That being said, it reminded me what took Game of Thrones, one of the many things that took it to the next level above other TV shows, and it was its secondary characters like Bronn, like the Hound. These are secondary characters who are better than most main characters on most shows ever made. If you think about popular shit today, like Ozark, I'll throw one out that I'm watching right now. The secondary characters don't hold anywhere near the amount of weight that a guy like the Hound or Bronn carries as a secondary character in Game of Thrones. And we had 30 of these fucking secondary characters to love that. Now, I'll throw out an example of a show, Barrett, that does have secondary characters on the level of Game of Thrones, and it's Tiger King.
Ah, yes. Yeah, very good.
That's the only thing I could think of.
Good point there. I don't know if you paid attention in the last week, I believe, maybe it was 2 weeks ago now, but with The Ringer did their like top, they did their big bracket, like a March Madness style best character of the century so far.
I saw the first round and I had to peel myself away I just couldn't do it. It was too, you know how those are. Too much frustration.
So there was, so they included three Game of Thrones characters in that bracket, and they were Arya, Cersei, and Tyrion. So my question for you is: do you think that for a best character, are those the three that you would have pulled from Game of Thrones?
I don't think putting Arya in there is realistic, man. That seems like a It's like a fucking one of those awards you get, but it's just recognition. It's not real.
So Arya made it to the final four of this bracket.
That's nutty to me. Considering the way her story wraps, considering the whole House of Black and White storyline? I just think that's an insane argument based on the popularity of the show.
So, so this got me thinking though, and I'm trying to think about
who would you pick from Game of Thrones?
Who had over the course of these eight seasons though the most to do, a lot of screen time, a long journey. And so the House of Black and White stuff and the Faceless Man stuff and her buddy copping with the Hound for a season, her arc was so big and so long, and so, you know, she went from one place and reached a totally different place. And I know a lot of characters did, but it's like you take somebody like Jon Snow. At the heart of Jon Snow, a boy becomes a man, right?
Sure, yes.
That's his arc.
Now, it's complicated, but sure.
A petulant boy becomes...
An ant-loving man.
A great leader of a man.
Incestuous man, yes.
For Arya, it's like this little tomboy girl, like, truly grows up and becomes
the savior of the world.
A cold-blooded assassin. I mean, like, that's... It's just... to get there, she went through... so many different things, so many interesting plot lines. I think with time, and you know, I think we talked about this on our, when we rewatched the season on the Night's Rewatch. I don't hate the House of Black and White stuff like I used to.
It's not that I hated it because of what it was. I hated it because the payoff was literally 20 seconds of slow motion sneakery. Her stabbing the Night King was the payoff for the House of Black and White, right? Like, it just seemed like that's what was frustrating about it. And then Jaqen H'ghar's whole exit with her, it was the confusion of like, wait, was she ever, was he training her always with this as her purpose? He knew, or was he, which, like, what was the thing here? That was what was confusing about it.
I mean, I would have liked, yeah, I totally agree. I would have liked a little bit more payoff. I would have liked to see her, have been able to use some of the Faceless Man stuff a little bit more besides just like the fighting, you know, and she does with Walder Frey and all that. But
yeah, we got some cool scenes, but it still wasn't as weighty as it should have been.
Yeah, I know. I'm with you there. But as far as that piece of that season goes, I don't mind it in hindsight.
That's fair to me. I think there's a lot of stuff like that where the build up was good. The payoff, not so much.
So I don't think it's crazy to that Arya was the kind of like the big winner character from Game of Thrones, especially given recency bias and the fact that she was the one that ends up taking out the Night King.
The problem... Go ahead.
Oh, I was just curious if you would make arguments for a different character being one of the three characters that would make a bracket like that.
Now, from a strictly on paper, where she starts to where she finishes on paper standpoint, I get why they chose Arya or why she makes it to the final four. But if I'm picking my Game of Thrones characters and you're giving me three slots to put into this bracket, she's not making the list because I'm looking at what you just said storyline wise. And man, it's the way Tyrion's storyline plays out during those first six seasons. It's the way Jaime's storyline plays out during those first six seasons. Peter Baelish, Littlefinger's storyline. I mean, there are several characters I would argue from a strictly the way it plays out on screen, not so much on paper, not the way it finishes in season eight. A lot of these guys, they're with Arya, you could argue the ending got bungled really badly and that you didn't get the payoff. Well, I felt like I got most of the payoff with a guy like Jaime, with a guy like Tyrion. Tyrion was season eight, as magical as I would have liked it to have been. I felt like for so many seasons, this was Tyrion's show. He was the main character. He was the best actor. Peter Dinklage was unbelievable. He had the best lines. He was the most interesting and unique. And he just, in season eight, what was he? He was an advisor who failed over and over and over and over until he basically has to sit back as a group, as part of the worst government ever formed, and and just watch things unfold.
Yeah, I think the Littlefinger note is a good one. He really was like one of the more fully fleshed out characters whose arc came to a very logical and satisfying conclusion.
arguably one of the best, most satisfying endings for characters on this show.
A guy that was the most conniving and knew how to play the game better than anyone finally ran out of moves, you know? And that was one that I think they... Execution of the Arya Sansa piece of that story.
Strange.
But for Littlefinger, really, really well done with him.
And honestly, looking back at it, Barrett,
seven.
Yeah, it's like we were so confused by Arya and Sansa. And that was the point. We were supposed to be like Littlefinger in that situation, not knowing what the hell was going on with these two sisters.
Anyway, I think that I didn't hate the three pulls. I feel compelled, you know, obviously I understand why Jorah, not a big enough character probably to kind of make that list, too many to choose from.
Man, it's 34 minutes in, we hadn't mentioned Jorah.
But I had to shout him out, just because I rides from a man's. And, but also, I'm a Daenerys stan too.
Yeah.
So I feel like she, I don't know, I could see her being in the Cersei position, maybe, instead of... I think I kind of like Tyrion and Arya as our two most interesting leads. And then I understand why you throw the big bad villain in there as three. But season eight really, like, it takes Cersei out of it, man. It really does.
And I mean, I think you could make the same argument for Dany in a lot of ways. But again, if I'm looking back, the first six seasons...
season eight. I mean, Daenerys is doing a ton of stuff.
Yes, it's just she's not
and then burns
doing,
an entire and then burns an entire city down. Like
it, she's
like
not she doing has, the things I expected her to do, though. It's okay, like she's okay. doing all this stuff where I'm like, Dany, after all this time, you know. So it's just, but I feel your argument.
You mentioned Tyrion as well, so I want to move on to Tyrion because. I have a few things that I probably think we should talk about for each of these episodes.
Oh yeah.
Your most disappointing piece of the episode on rewatch, your favorite thing of the episode on rewatch, and then just kind of anything that like we've already kind of been talking about some of this stuff, but things that were either better or worse for you than the first time around in your rewatch. So the on rewatch, most disappointing for me. Is that Tyrion is suddenly inept?
That he's literally useless.
I hate this, and I don't know how it's going to play out in the books, but everything we know, as Sansa even says, I used to think you were the cleverest man alive, and then he's suddenly like a bumbling idiot, literally. So naive and dumb that he thinks his sister is coming up to help fight with them.
It's one of the things I cannot wait to see how this plays out in the books because it was so weird in the story on television.
It's infuriating because everything we know, it's the most inexplicable like character shift to me. Daenerys becoming the Mad Queen is more believable than Tyrion suddenly being a fucking idiot.
Going from the most strategic and intelligent character on the show through seven seasons, really six and a half, to... a nonstop failure fest for the last season and a half.
Yeah.
Inexplicable.
It's it's a disservice to the character for me.
Yeah.
Because it's just a total letdown.
Can I give you my most disappointing thing of this episode?
I would like you to, yes.
It was the general recognition of setups that never deliver. And I'll give you the thing that really sunk it in for me finally. It was the message at the end of the episode from the Night King, the flaming dead screaming child. You're telling me the Night King and the Army of the Dead took the time to do that, to set that kid up on that wall, make a fucking octopus out of dead bodies, to do all the shit they did this past seven seasons. Think about all the shit they did, all the time they spent slaughtering, designing human bodies into strange patterns on the floor. And Sun didn't say a word when he finally got to Winterfell and they were like, fuck it, we can't come up with anything. Let's just have Arya kill the bastard. That type of setup was the thing that in this episode reminded me, man, they fumbled so many pieces to this puzzle. Theon just walking onto the ship and taking Yara back, like, inexplicably, and then me thinking to myself, because there's this whole setup, right? Oh, the Iron Islands will potentially be the zombie refuge. And you're like, okay, so Yara's going to go secure that. Does she ever even come back? The whole thing, incredibly strange in hindsight, considering it doesn't matter. And she delivers lines like, what is dead may never die, but kill the bastards anyway. It's like, there's too many scenes in the episode that you're like, because we know they don't deliver. Now in hindsight, you're like, damn, this was a good scene that really had this setup for like, I was hyped to see this play out, and it never happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was, so it ended up being, if you're going to make me pick a scene, it's the message at the end, because it was okay. This incredible reminder that like, oh my God, they fucked this up so bad. But it really in general was, there were several moments that delivered these bigger setups that then I was realizing, oh my God, these never deliver.
Yeah. Definitely. The end of the episode with the flaming limbs and the zombie child screaming with a knife, it gave me the exact same thought where I was like, man, this didn't amount to anything. This was pointless. Now, having said that, I have the entire last 10 minutes as my like favorite piece of the episode rewatch.
And why is that?
And I really, this episode finally finds its like flow in that last 10 minutes. And I like each of the individual pieces that happen, and they all make sense as like a lead up, like into what we should see occur next. But so from Sam running down to the crypts to like finally tell Jon that he's Aegon Targaryen, and then into, Bran meeting Sam, or I'm sorry,
meeting Jaime.
Sorry. Sam in the crypts talking to Jon. The Night's Watch meeting up with Tormund and some of the wildlings.
I've always had blue eyes.
At Last Hearth. The always have blue eyes moment and line is fantastic. And then that scene is so good. So I totally understand why it's on your disappointment list, because it's such a cool, horrifying, you know, visual to get there. And you're just like, it's one of those, oh shit moments. Like you don't generally get to see something that cool and that scary and that good on TV. And then it ends up being pointless and meaning nothing. But for the moment, I like that. I love those two groups meeting. I love the burning limbs, like, you know, visual. It's really crazy and scary and good. And then, of course, Bran and Jaime locking eyes there at Winterfell. So I just really liked that, the flow of those last 10 minutes. I think all those scenes work pretty well. And so that was my episode kind of highlight. But totally with you on the disappointment of that really cool, scary, spirally, what does it all mean message ends up, doesn't mean much.
And you hit the nail on the head. That's why it was the most disappointing moment to me, because I think it was the most exciting moment in the episode, and it ends up being total and utter poppycock, obviously. Also, Bran waiting for Jaime in the courtyard, and by the way, that scene's like 8 minutes long. Jaime hooded for like 6.5 minutes, and then them staring at each other for 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
It just seemed like, come on, guys. But I laughed out loud, dude, because of all the Bran memes, just thinking about, look, knowing now that Bran ends up, what do you think I came all this way for, Ing? Makes every single one of his scenes so unintentionally hilarious that it's fucking, I just, dude, can you imagine all the actors who had done the script reads filming these episodes? Like, you can see the disappointment on some, like Jon Snow's general demeanor, the fact that he struggled with alcohol abuse during the filming of the season, Kit Harington did, is the least shocking thing of all time in hindsight, because, yo, they all knew, like, oh, okay. You can almost feel it. Everybody on this show knew, okay, this is, I don't know, but like, I'm telling you, I think they all just leaned into like, you know what, fuck it, we accomplished something crazy here, we're going to close it out, however that goes together, and we're going to have a good time doing it. Maybe it's the middle of the night, we don't get to sleep anymore, and this is miserable filming, but fuck it. Like, I get that feeling through the screen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what about for you? What about something that, anything that did work well this time around then?
Again, I think the biggest recognition for me in this episode was another one of the biggest things was the secondary characters. So like we brought up another one, Tormund, that he really only, he has that one really, really great line in this episode. And he's really not all that like, it was never going to be able to deliver all of our secondary characters with full blown storylines that gave us satisfaction. Yeah, yeah. But he's an example of another secondary character that I thought, I mean, I missed him. I loved him so much. There's so many. If you just pull up, Google Game of Thrones characters and start looking down the list, and it's like you find yourself just being like, I miss this person, 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 because these characters, it's what made the show so great. We got so much from so many different characters to the point that we felt like we knew them, and then it was just not able to, like you said, if they'd given us 20 episodes, it would have been able to deliver on all that, on all the buildup. But this was never going to be as satisfying as we wanted it to be. And I think we all kind of knew that going in, but we weren't willing to admit to ourselves just how weird things might get with only 6 episodes trying to wrap up the most complicated story ever told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah, it's just to spin off again. You mentioned Tormund. We talked about his line there at the end in the final scene, which I think we both really liked. I think we both thought that one worked.
I thought he crushed it, and it was very funny, and their reaction from, what's his name, Ed, was perfect. All
Ed,
great.
Dolores Ed, yeah. Now, having said that, here's another thing that struck me, stood out to me on this episode, that didn't work for me as well this time around. And I don't know if this is because we have spent so... You and I and everybody and just kind of... Look, the shows that have been out recently that we've watched, The Outsider, Plot Against America, even Westworld to a degree, like, Debs, like, we've really gotten in a spot on TV where shows don't feel the need to inject any type of lightness into what we're seeing on screen, right? And we talk about that a lot, about how we enjoy when those super dark shows allow us a moment of levity.
Yes.
Like, they allow a moment to be light or to be funny, because it's such a slog. It weighs you down so much to just watch something that is just dark, dark, dark the entire time. This episode has so many one-liners. I thought it had too many.
Like, they were forced in. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, there are so many little jokes here, jokes there, punchline, one-liner.
I'll throw some perfect examples at you when you're ready.
Those were always on Game of Thrones. They've always been a piece of this soup, right? An ingredient in this big stew that has been one of the reasons the show is enjoyable.
Baby,
because the story's good, the characters are great. It's dark. It's heavy. It's serious. It you know, it's all meaningful. We're invested, and yet the show is still funny. This one I just thought this episode had too many. It's like they were like, okay, and don't forget, we also need to be funny. The show's also got to be funny.
You know who was the I literally wrote this note. The Hound, our man who delivers lines on the level of Tormund's, my eyes were always blue, every episode, whole series. The Hound's lines in this episode are not good enough. He delivers one about cripples and cocksuckers are the only ones who make weapons for the wildlings. Which one are you? Nope. Didn't hit. missed hard. And it just really, like, he was the thing that showed me that line in particular. I was like, it clicked. Damn. It's the same thing as with these plot points. They sort of plotted out, like, all right, here's a spot for a funny ass line. Let's force one in. Like, that it's just sort of forced. That didn't hit like it usually did. I'm totally with you. There was several lines like that in this episode that, unlike Tormund's, I thought were evident that they had sort of lost their fastball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, or just, like you said, just kind of shoehorned in for the purpose of trying to tell a joke instead of because it's something that the character would say.
Now, same thing happened for me in one of what should have been the more powerful scenes in maybe the history of the show, where John rides Rhaegal for the first time, and it's so magical until you remember they shipped this fool back to the Night's Watch, which is still the funniest troll job in the history of television and entertainment. But there were multiple lines, like, "You completely ruined horses for me," and "We could stay here 1,000 years. Nobody would find us." And John responds, "We'd be pretty old." And then this whole scene with them making out and Drogon watching, like, this is the one that it hit me. Oh my God. All of these people are just having, this is them just in trying to enjoy closing the show out. Like, that scene was what? The dragon is a perv.
I liked this scene. I liked all this.
But the lines.
I was down with the lines.
We'd be pretty old. But again, you know what? Maybe that's the thing, is it's like we had just hit a point where anything Jon Snow said was going to be kind of funny.
Yeah, and I totally disagree with you. You just said that sending Jon Snow back to the Night's Watch, I'm doing air quotes, because of course he's not actually going back to the Night's Watch. I loved that. I thought that was a great... I'm so down with him going back to become a wildling. That makes perfect sense to me.
Okay, fair enough.
But yes, there were many, and even though I liked the Rhaegal ride, I liked his moment with Daenerys here, the kind of their last... This is their last instance of truly being on the same page and getting to show.
They're Aladdin, I can show you the world moment.
How much they care about each other, and then it all crumbles after this. You know, maybe I like this because I was just rooting for the incest to continue. You know what I mean? Like, like I just wanted them to figure out a way to tell us that John and Danny could be together and that that's okay in this world because it's a different era. It's different times, man.
I wanted that so bad, dude. I won't lie to you. I just wanted them to put in a loophole where I could go, you know what? Fuck all these haters.
Yeah, yeah. So I did like that. And it clearly, like, the scenes were reminiscent of John and Ygritte kind of talking about how they could stay in the cave forever.
Ygritte.
Yeah, and you know, I was okay with that. I was okay with this scene, the Aladdin scene,
all right,
if you called it.
All right.
Honestly, my one note from this scene is not that Daenerys doesn't always kind of have a little bit of Emilia Clarke in her, but I thought Emilia really shone through in some of the looks and the lines here. And I just obviously one of the reasons why we root so hard for Daenerys is because Emilia Clarke, the actress, is so charming and she brings that to the character, right? So that makes it extra difficult to kind of like reconcile with the fact that she turns into a mass murderer. but I just wonder though, like, I wonder what the season would have looked like if they make her a little sharper, a little earlier.
I felt that too, man.
Don't quite let so much of Emilia's bubbliness and charm come through.
It did seem, and this may have been the result of her personal situation, it did seem, and maybe it's just that we'd gotten to know Emilia Clarke so well that it was easier to see her through Danny. But I felt that exact same thing where I was like, it just wasn't as honestly, man, maybe it's that she read the damn script and went, what? I'm like the Hitler of fucking Westeros? Fuck. Maybe that was it. I don't know. But I'm with you. I felt a little off with Danny through episode one. It'll be interesting to see how we feel about her by the end.
Yeah, I mean, just obviously we know the storyline now. We know what happens, and I'm just kind of thinking about moving forward there. And it's like, you know, it's just an interesting piece of the puzzle that this moment, and maybe this was purposeful that they give us this last moment of really really liking her and liking them together. So
Can I run through a couple more of the random notes I had?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So Arya and Gendry building their sexual tension in this episode, and when we immediately become terrified that they're going to bone, and I remember the moment you and me talked about, like, are they gonna do this? Is this a thing that's going to happen? And the best part, one of my favorite parts, and it's a decent setup, she hands him the paper and says, here's my wish. Can you make it? And it was maybe the first moment in television history, I think it could be argued, if you went back to the writer's room, that they thought about the memes that could come about as a result. And I mean, because the possibilities were just endless. It could have been an orgasm. It could have been an engagement ring, a perfect penis, a four-car garage that she drew on the piece of paper. Just the her handing him, here's my wish. Can you make it? And him being like, first of all, don't we see it and it's like dildo looking?
It could be construed as phallic, I would say.
Phallic.
It's pretty clearly like a spear with a knife on the end of it that like detaches or whatever. But you know, it's long, it's straight, it's pointy. So
does she use it on the Night King?
No.
What?
She fights with it at the Battle of Winterfell.
Oh, yeah, that's tight. That's tight. I will note I was confused by the episode being titled Winterfell.
Mm.
This one.
I was like, did you think we were getting the Battle of Winterfell just right off the bat?
Yeah. In my head, I was like, wait a minute. Don't we need some setup here? Danny meeting Sam and figuring out that she killed his dad and brother. The look on Danny's face when she's like,
tough scene.
Did you say Tarly? And he's like, I did. Big fan. My dad, my brother. And she's like, ah, Tarly, ringing a bell. Oh, no. And then Sam going and telling John that she murdered his family. And John's response is, I'm so sorry. We have to end this war. And Sam's like, I don't know if you heard me, but she roasted my dad and brother. Also, you know what? Fuck it. You're a Targaryen. How's that for a subject change if you want to be a dick?
Yeah. So although I do, like I said, I like the last 10 minutes of this episode. Thought that these moments all work the best and flow together pretty naturally, which sets up for, you know, it just creates a nice ending for this episode. I struggle with the progression there from Sam learning about his dad and brother to then going and essentially, like, because, okay, here's the thing. Those beats that you just pointed out, right? Like, because he learns about Daenerys killing his dad and his brother, and then goes and runs and tells John, it does create this sense that this big reveal is now some sort of like tattletaling.
Yeah.
Instead of this weighty moment that John needs to know because it's important, because it's who he is.
Yeah, I felt that shit,
right?
Too.
This is your origin, John. You are a Targaryen, not a Stark. This is meaningful because it's your history. It's your past. It's who you are, right? It's your identity. Thank you. Yes. And instead, it's like you get this, like, Sam's just suddenly pissed off because he learned that Danny had to whack his family members, and it runs to tell John something that he thinks could sabotage Daenerys.
Yes, which is not the look that we would expect from Sam.
Yeah. So it's more about, I'm upset, I'm hurt, and so now I'm going to try to hurt Danny by letting John know about this deep, dark secret. Instead of I'm informing you about this because I know it's important. It would be important for you to know.
It took away the weight of what should have been one of the biggest moments in this show ever, right?
Yeah,
John,
yes.
How many seasons of build-up, man, to find out who he is, his heritage, who's his mother, getting the scene in the Tower of Joy, all that playing out in the incredibly dramatic and, might I add, beautiful fashion that it does. And then to have this sort of be the payoff between these two best friends, with one telling the other, look, dude, I know the most important thing anybody's ever going to tell you. The most important piece of information that's ever going to be shared with you.
Yeah.
And I'm now sharing it with you out of spite.
Yes. Yep, exactly. And so I don't blame John for his reaction there either, because look, man, what do we know about Westeros? What do we know about this world? Like, kings and queens have to make super difficult decisions all the time. And we're not at a point yet here where, like, blood and fury don't matter. It's not a democracy yet. There are no elected officials. Like, so these two dudes, and I'm probably reissuing statements that I'm sure I made on the first go around too, because I just don't agree with Sam here. I understand his hurt. I understand his disappointment, especially for the loss of Dickon. But these two dudes were given the option to be prisoners. They were given the option of mercy.
No, it's the lack of a good enough explanation.
And they said, nah, I'll take the execution instead. So it doesn't matter to me that John maybe wouldn't have executed them in that same position.
Yeah, I don't even understand why he asks him that. Like, would you have done?
The point here is that Dany did actually, she did offer them a choice, just like she offered everybody there. And guess what? She did not burn everybody that day. Everybody that bent the knee got saved.
But suddenly that conversation makes me think, like, is Sam asking John, would you have done it, in an attempt to judge his worthiness to be leader? Because up at no point has Sam questioned John's abilities or judgment or...
No, it's a rhetorical question. He knows John wouldn't have done
it. Oh, so he asks him to get him to realize...
that he's a better option for king because he's more merciful and you know, acts with more justice, I guess.
Yeah, everything in that scene just kind of hits different than we... I think we all expected this moment of, like... because we waited forever. We knew this was coming. Mm-hmm. And we expected this moment of, like, oh... And then it's more like... And you're just like, what the fuck is happening? It's like... And it really, Barrett, my issue with it was that it presented us with a conflict we had already known we were going to have for over a year at the end of the first episode, which was that John versus Dany is a problem. Mm-hmm. It sort of like throws that up as like the big ooh thing at the end of the episode. And it's like, other than the Flaming Child. And we knew that, man. We've been knowing that and thinking about it forever. So like to have the Sam's thing not hit the way we wanted.
Yeah.
To not have it be this big magical moment, and then to also have it be something that's sort of like John versus Dany, remember? And we're like, we know, we fucking know.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I'm going to take it one step further. When you really break it down and think about it, Sam and Bran, by extension, could really easily be to blame for all of the millions of lives that were lost in King's Landing.
Horrible mismanagement.
If they don't reveal this to John right now, which they do because they're angry, which Sam does because he's angry, then John and Daenerys keep getting to lead their happy little life, and that would keep her from becoming distanced and pissed off and isolated and by herself and alone, like. Yes, bad management, Bran, and bad management, Sam. And now you see all these Bran scenes with the knowledge that he actually ends up becoming king. Look, man, maybe there is like a deep-seated little string here that is like Bran knows this whole time and he is kind of a dick and a bad guy.
It's
because you could theoretically wait until you win this war and capture King's Landing to bring this whole thing up.
That's what's really interesting. And I think it'll be my number one thing throughout the course of the rest of this season that I look to draw from, how Bran behaves. Because the theory, the argument that people were making during the run of season 8 that, look, Bran is a bad guy. Bran allowed all this to happen, plotted it. Arguably, Bran is the big villain, not the Night King.
Yeah.
That gets more weight with every passing second when you really think about how it's to because we're calling it mismanagement, but it really, in hindsight, looks like a well-executed plan for a man
sabotage.
Who wanted to end up on the Iron Throne.
Yeah.
Or thought that was the best call, whether it was just because out of selfishness or literally he was doing it because what's the dude in Watchmen? Ozymandias. Is that how it's pronounced? always reminds me of that now, right? Like the guy who has to do something that seems bad, but to save a whole bunch of people.
Yes. What is to a lot of these madmen, right? Like, what's the best way to get people to United is by having something horrific happening, uniting around a mass tragedy.
And that's exactly what Bran allows.
That's exactly what Bran does. Yep.
It's just very interesting. And I think it's the one piece, Barrett, that I wonder in longer term, is it that Benioff and Weiss weren't allowed to explain this piece of the puzzle more properly after the fact because it's going to be a huge reveal in the books? That is a thing I think is a very real possibility at this point when you look at Bran's storyline. And his lines in this episode, dude, the way they're delivered, the look on his face, it's all very, very mysterious.
Mm-hmm. Good question. It's also possible that they kind of that all they knew were like we said, were some of these main points, right? That they know these from George, and they execute on them in the way that they, you know, thought was appropriate, and they kind of stumbled into making Bran look like a bad guy, and then actually in the books when we have way more time and far more pages and just more, you know, more leeway to tell this story.
And a talented writer.
Like, yeah. Like I'm with you. I will be interested to see if when and if these books finally come out, if there's a lot more in there that points to, or then in the end explicitly says that like Bran is actually a villain.
I'm also just to make something I'm excited about for the rest of the season. I'm not only watching Bran and really digging into that, but Jon Snow just saying all the different versions of "I don't want it," "I didn't want it," "I never wanted it," all season long, baby. It's just going to be nonstop Jon Snow apologist behavior, and I'm all in on that. Barrett, after episode one. Mm-hmm. I don't think we all knew how weird things would get during season 8, but I will say this. There were certainly enough breadcrumbs for us to start to realize, uh-oh. And
definitely,
while we had big moments that I think delivered, in the big grand scheme of things, in the big picture, they don't fit perfectly, and it's just overall begins the strange saga of season 8, the closeout of what is arguably the greatest show ever made, Game of Thrones. And it's not only that this is going to be incredibly fun to rewatch. I literally have not seen a single one of the episodes since we've ended coverage of season 8 on Game of Thrones, or on Oysters, Clams, and Cockles in 2018, 19 or whatever. I'm excited to see all the different pieces that I was only able to see as infuriating or frustrating before in a totally different light with some positivity. Because like we're making I'm going to continue to lodge my complaints and continue to point out really funny missteps all season long. But the important thing to remember is I still think, even with trash storytelling, this is one of the greatest things ever accomplished on screen. And I would argue in a similar vein, Westworld has found itself in one of these places with some of the storytelling that's gone on in season 3 as well. And it's a reminder. What we got in Game of Thrones seasons 1 through 6 and arguably 7 was not only an anomaly, it was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. This isn't a thing that we will likely get to enjoy again. And Barrett, as I've talked about recently on both Twitch and on Freeze on Motor Functions, because you pointed this out over and over and over, it was appointment viewing for the last time in that era. Now, we're getting versions of it springing back up, Devs on Thursday, but nobody watches it. Nobody on not all of America sits down and watches Devs on Thursday night. We did with Game of Thrones every single Sunday. So it's having the respect for that, enjoying the closeout, knowing things didn't go exactly as we all wanted them to, and also taking into consideration some of these angles that we couldn't before, like, wait a minute, maybe this was more intentional than we realize, and they just weren't able to give us the full explanation yet because of the way these contracts were set up. I don't know, but I can't tell y'all how excited I am to be here and to be doing the Night's Rewatch, to be doing Season 8 again. I know Barrett feels the same way. We are so stoked. Thank you all for your support. Mr. Dudley, any final words on Episode 1 of Season 8?
No, a lot of stuff that I'm obviously going to save for these future discussions. But just along with everything that you just said about how interesting this is to go back over, I am constantly thinking as we're rewatching this about what I think this season does to the show's legacy as a whole, and then what that legacy ends up being in the years to come. And that's obviously something that we won't really know until we get there. But I'm going to have some fun with kind of trying to project what I think it will look like, you know, down the line. So yeah, I'm stoked. And as many errors as we're finding on this rewatch, on this autopsy, it's still like. So it was still extremely exciting to put this show up.
Just even hearing the theme music had me aroused.
Like last night, like going to the HBO Go app and like going to Game of Thrones and like seeing this all laid out. It's just it's still, and that's kind of one of the that's kind of what I was saying up front when I was just kind of talking about fantasy in general, right? It's like removed from those first six seasons. This is fun stuff. This is good. This is good stuff. It's just when you're batting 1,000, suddenly batting, you know, which is, you know, unheard of, then you start batting 450 and it's like, well, what is this? What is happening?
They had set the bar for themselves, and we all need to remember that. And I think that's totally fair, man. It was way too easy for everybody to hate on Thrones season 8. And listen, every TV show you watch has problems and things you can nitpick and bullshit about it that's like totally inexplicable or just horrible writing or a bad idea. Thrones was executed so well through the first six seasons that some argue, like in hindsight, fucking stupid complaints that we were lodging about the time traveling and how fast things were going. Baby, we didn't know how good we had it. You know what I mean? Like that, dude, we were in the motherfucking zone. And did season 8 close like we wanted? No. Was it still better than 99.9% of things ever made ever in any art form? Yes. It was it the big moments that they were able to present us with, Barrett, that we're going to get to when we get to the Battle of Winterfell, that we're going to get to when we get to Arya and all these big, big storyboard fucking, what do you call them, whiteboard moments that they clearly wrote up on there and they were like, we got to hit this, we got to hit this, we got to hit this. Now, how do we get there? Those moments are still insane. Now, some of them, it's too dark. I'll say that. But they're still insane. I can't wait to get to them. We all knew season 8 was weird. Enjoying it without the weight and the pressure of please close strong, please hit the landing is going to be awesome. I'm stoked to be here. And thank you all for joining us.
Indeed.
Yeah. Until next time, Clam Fam, Crustacean Nation, Mollusk Militia.
But both me brothers were soldiers.
You have to do it again. Yes, you have yes. to. One more time.
But both me brothers were soldiers.
Adios, muchachos.
I couldn't get the high register on that one. But don't worry. We'll do it again.
All season long, baby.
Bye-bye.
The episode you just enjoyed was originally recorded in the summer of 2020 for patreon.com/oystersclamscockles, where you can find bonus coverage and content for House of the Dragon Season 1 starting the week of August 21st in exchange for your support. Barrett and I also recently finished recording a companion podcast for every episode of HBO's classic crime drama The Sopranos, friendly to first-timers and rewatchers, available exclusively on patreon.com/oystersclamscockles. Again, House of the Dragon coverage starts August 21st right here on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you are listening, with a recap and reaction episode dropping just hours after the premiere. And yes, bonus content and coverage, including hotline calls, will be available on Patreon. Every episode of House of the Dragon coverage will also be available to watch on YouTube. Follow us on TikTok at Oysters, Clams, and Cockles, on Instagram at Oysters, Clams, Cockles, and on Twitter at Clams and Cockles. Follow me, Ross Bolin, at WR Bolin on Twitter and Instagram, and check out the Ross Bolin podcast wherever you listen to OCC. Follow Barrett Dudley at Barrett Dudley on Twitter and Instagram. Shop merch at bolinmedia.com/shop. Tell everyone you know that OCC is back. Spread the word far and wide, and we'll see you here right after the premiere of House of the Dragon.